They needed devices that could read over his shoulder every book he opened, every page of figures he made. They needed to fix up his workroom in his office and rig it so that every resistor he picked up, every wire he put in, would be recorded exactly. It was certain that he would sweep the place with a probe before every work period and possibly after every day of toil. He would be meticulous in his bug detection. If Turl had any inkling the technology would be observed, he would not start. If he thought it had been taken away by an alien, he would commit suicide. For there was no doubt that Turl had in his skull both the devices they had found in the dead cyclos. Before they had left Africa, Dr. McKendrick had been very pessimistic about being able to remove such brain devices from all that bone and still have a live, functioning cyclo on his hands. That chance was not entirely gone, but it was nothing to be counted on. Angus had lately begun to understand why Johnny had kept Turl alive, why they didn't just get out some battle planes and wipe this new political mess out. It was a very delicate situation. It was a thin chance. It had to work. But with what risks? Angus had no doubt whatever that Johnny was holding his own life at stake. A huge and dangerous risk. But what a prize. The cyclo technology of teleportation. Earth depended upon it. Johnny was a cool one, Angus thought. He himself would never have that much patience or be able to retain that detached an overview of the entire scene without permitting personal considerations from entering in. Angus looked up from the locks. He was in awe of Johnny as he thought about what they were doing. These people or Turl would kill Johnny in a flash if they found him or knew what he was up to. Robert the Fox had denounced it as folly and a hopeless, unwarranted risk. Angus didn't think so. It was a brand of courage he had never seen before. He got the cabinets opened. They contained all the paraphernalia a security chief ever thought he would need. They contained papers and records Turl would consider vital. Johnny was looking for super-confidential notes on teleportation or its odd mathematics. On his inspection, he did not find anything on those subjects beyond normal tests. But he did find an item of interest. It was a record of all the mineral deposits left on Earth. The company had not made a mineral survey for itself for centuries, content with their originals. But Turl had. Johnny smiled. There were 16 loads of gold on the planet, almost as good as the one they had mined. In the Andes and the Himalayas. They just weren't that close to home, and it would have been more public to have mined them. Ah, yes. All these other lodes were also associated with uranium. There were thick records of Earth's existing mineral resources. Hundreds of years of security chiefs had continued to log the findings of the drones, which were used for security but were essentially mineral spotters. The company, with its semi-core methods of mining, could go down almost to the molten core, to the very bottom of the crust, without breaking through. And they were content to mine what they had and conserve their assets of unmined wealth. Turl had simply removed the records from company view for his own purposes. Ores. Metals. The planet was still wealthy in resources. Johnny recorded every page rapidly. This was not what he was here for, but it was nice to know their planet had not been bankrupted of minerals. They would need them. Angus had found what they were really looking for just now, Turl's bug probe. It was an oblong box with an aerial sticking out of it and a disc cup on the tip of the aerial. It had on-off switches for various frequencies and light domes and buzzers. Johnny had done his apprenticeship well in the electronics shop. He knew that no wave this could detect would pass through lead or a lead alloy. Ordinarily, this would not be a factor since any bug of any kind whatsoever would also not pass through lead. Therefore, why detect it since it wouldn't work as a bug or button camera if it had lead over it? The first job was to rig these switches. Johnny made a trip to electronics stores and got what he wanted. He came back to find that Care had swept the area for bugs and found none. They chose where Turl would do his shop work, in Chirk's former reception office. It was big enough to work in, and the size console it would be would go in and out of the door. While Johnny, at his desk, worked on the bug probe, the other two rigged a workbench out of a metal slab and welded it to the floor, and then armor-annealed the welds so it would be an awful lot of trouble to move. They even got a stool and put it in front of it. When they had finished, they had a very nice layout. Johnny moved his work over to it. He had made excellent progress. Using micro-button transmitters employed normally in remote controls, he had rigged every switch in the probe so that when it was turned on, it would send out an impulse from the remote relay. These relays took a microscope to see properly. They were fastened in with a small molecular spray. The worst part was getting them to stay where one wanted them while spraying them down. But the eye that could detect them unaided had never been made. Using a scope set at a distance from the probe, he clicked each switch on in turn, and the scope bounced in response. The next part was hard because it involved the adaptation of iris sleeves taken from tubes of plane viewers. These were small devices that automatically adjusted the volume of a light path. They would close their concentric leaves from wide open to shut. They had to take these delicate things apart and spray them, molecules thick, with lead and reassemble them so they would not only work, but would go on working, opening and closing. Angus was the best at this sort of work. Then they got some contraction rings and put them around these leaded irises and installed micro-buttons in them to activate them. When they had built about 15 of these, they made a thorough and extensive test. When the probe was clicked on, the iris instantly closed. When the probe was turned off, the irises sprang open. In other words, the leaded irises would be shut whenever the probe was on, thus putting a lead screen over any bug and making it undetectable, and for the moment, unable to see and hear. But when the probe was off, the screen would be off, and any bug or device could see and hear. So far, so good. They now went on an extensive tour of the storerooms, telling Lars, who showed up, that they were looking for spindle buffers, and located not only every other bug probe in the compound, but also every other key component it took to make a bug probe. They put these in a box and put the box in their car to be transported out of the country. They now had a probe that wouldn't probe, while obviously working, and 15 irises they could put in front of bug devices. Lars popped up again, saying they sure were quiet, and they told him to get lost. But presently, Kerr took a disc recording of hammering and pounding and drilling and let it play. They cleaned up traces of their work so far and hid their products. Suddenly, they realized it had been a long day. They hadn't eaten. They had a long way to go, but that, they agreed, was enough for now. Johnny and Angus, not wanting to tempt the fates by running into too many cadets at the academy, elected to bed down in Char's old quarters. Kerr was going to drive back to the academy and get them something to eat and bring them some work clothes. Dunnell Dean should be there now, and Johnny had a message for him about the cyclos. Johnny typed it out on Shirk's writing machine. All's well. In 3 days, engineer the transportation of the 33 P's, now in compound jailhouse, to stated destination Cornwall. Report them crashed at sea. Deliver to the doctor. Not before 3 days. You will have no trouble with them. They'll be screaming to leave. Eat this note. Kerr said he'd deliver it and rushed away. Johnny and Angus stretched out to unwind. So far, it was okay. They had a ways to go.